Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to change things up a little bit. You heard about Stephanie Ritzler's South Dakota Focus coming up on Thursday as we talk with about issues of mental health. And now we're going to bring you a conversation with North Dakota Prairie Public's Doug Hamilton. He spoke with Dr. Lim, who is a vice chair for research in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota. Next, you'll hear a discussion regarding the research he has been conducting into addiction.
We've got a wonderful expert to talk about a serious problem, a social problem nationally and locally, and a health problem as well. Dr. Kelvin Lim is the vice chair for research in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota, and we're going to talk specifically about research that he has been conducting into addiction. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Lim.
Pleasure to be here.
I did a little research about your background. You've been in this endeavor for many years now, but you started with an interest in consciousness and meditation. How did that evolve into addiction research?
You know, I think it just shows how there's this path of serendipity that makes itself apparent when we are not expecting it. But basically, my interest in brain and approaches toward consciousness began early in my medical school career when I learned to meditate because I was overwhelmed by the stress of medical school.
Well, that makes sense. Is there any correlation at all, or is this just a leap?
Well, you know, I think it's that main connection with just an interest in the brain and how the brain the brain is obviously intimately involved with the experiences that we have, and led to my interest in becoming a psychiatrist and from the clinical phenomenon, the disorders, psychiatric disorders that we deal with.
What drew you to addiction research?
Well, I think it's something that we know just from our own experiences, from my clinical experience of just how prevalent this is. You know, the numbers are, if you look at issues and even in terms of primary care programs, one of the big issues, clinical issues that primary care practitioners face is issues around depression and substance use are two of the big ones that people deal with, and the prevalence is estimated at 20-25% of the population at some point have problems with this.
And something like almost 8% of the population have a substance use disorder, an active one. So this is a big deal.
It is. It is. And, you know, as many of, you know, well, from clinical experiences, we know even from our own personal experience, we know that people faced with substance use disorders, often have great difficulty in dealing with it.
Well, let's talk specifically about your research, because you're using brain scans, specifically an MRI, as a research tool. Explain to our listeners how that works.
Well, we use a magnetic resonance imaging scanner that many people are familiar with that are used for clinical purposes. We're very fortunate here at the University of Minnesota to have a very world premier, world-class imaging center in which we have several, or actually many, MR magnets designed specifically and focused on research, including field strengths, typical field strengths, for example, for clinical scanners is 1.5 Tesla or 3 Tesla. We have machines to go now up to 10.5 Tesla in terms of strength, which give us better signal and improved imaging.
Is that in any way?
And we use these tools to really examine what is happening in the brain in many different brain disorders.
When you talk about that strength, is that anything that would threaten the health of a patient, or is that just something that enhances the imaging?
Well, one always has to be careful for any type of MR, magnetic resonance, that one doesn't have metal in the body. And so that's why when you go to have a clinical MRI scan, they are very thorough about screening you for any metal that you may have on your body or in your body, such as medical implants, that type of thing. But it is very safe. It has no ionizing radiation like X-rays. And so it is a wonderful tool for for research and for studying the brain.
Well, with the enhanced MRI tool that you use, what do the brain scans show about the brain's reaction to addictive substances?
Well, our focus has really been in looking at how using a technique that is the MR scanner can do, basically something called functional MRI, which allows us to examine the brain activity over time. So, for example, we're able to take many snapshots of the brain, say maybe three or four, like every second we can take a picture of the brain. And then that picture can give us information about the actual activity in the brain. And we're using that type of information to examine how are different parts of the brain talking to each other.
And the two principal parts, I take it, are the prefrontal cortex and the nucleus accumbens.
Well, those are the ones that we have, our research has led us to focus on. The nucleus accumbens is a key part of what's called the reward center of the brain. It's what provides us key motivation for reward, for things that we want. For example, food, or in our situation, what we're talking about, things that bring pleasure, such for some people, such as drugs. And so reward centers seem like a very important part of the brain.
And the prefrontal cortex is where we're doing the thinking?
Well, the prefrontal cortex in particular is very important for planning a behavior and for decision making. So it's like making the choice. So let's come up with a kind of example. Let's say you're there at dinner and you're trying to decide, should I have the second cookie, right? Okay? And because the first cookie was very good. And so there's still more cookies on the plate. And so your nucleus making a story here, but let's say the nucleus that comes and says, oh, that first one was very good. We should have the second one. But the prefrontal cortex, which is involved in planning and decision-making, saying, you know, we looked at the scale earlier this morning, and it's not going in the right direction. We should not have that cookie. So there's a tug of war there, right? That's how we've been thinking about it. There's kind of a tug of war there between the prefrontal cortex and the nucleus accumbens.
So in an addicted person, is the nucleus accumbens winning?
Well, what we found, okay, was one of the things that I've been very interested in, or my group has been very interested in, is are there signals in the brain that can tell us that someone is going to relapse to use? And so we conducted a study where we followed people who are already in treatment, and so they are already abstinent, and scanned them, and then followed them and to see who relapses and who stays sober. And what we found is that when we looked at the connection, the strength of communication between nucleus accumbens and prefrontal cortex, we found that if you had a strong communication between that prefrontal cortex and nucleus accumbens, you most likely were going to stay clean. You were going to stay sober.
Huh.
But if that signal was low, most likely you would go on to relapse. That's really the fundamental, you know, finding that was very exciting to us.
Do different addictive substances, you know, alcohol or cocaine, show up differently in this kind of research? Or are all addictive substances affecting these two areas in similar ways?
We haven't done an exhaustive study across many, many different substances yet, but we do have experience in alcohol and also in people using stimulants. And with both of those substances, we get a similar kind of finding about the communication between, the importance of this communication between nucleus accumbens and prefrontal cortex.
So is there anything that indicates why some people are more predisposed to addiction? Or is that indeed the case?
You know, I think that is a very interesting question, because you know there's certainly genetic influences, there are environmental influences, and one of the things that's key in appreciating the limitations of, for example, our study is that these are people who were already in treatment for substance use disorder. And so what would be very interesting to answer this question that you've asked is, can we look at people before they've had any substance use or even exposure to substances to see if there are similar, to see what kinds of connectivity patterns there are in people?
That is a question. Could this research be used to indicate who is predisposed to addiction?
You know, I think that this research gives us a potential avenue, a potential starting point. I think one of the studies that's actually just starting is the ABCD study, which is a study being led through the National Institutes of Drug Abuse, in which they are looking at starting with children at the age of 10 and following 10,000 children, looking at imaging and other measures, and it's expected to be a 10-year study in which they hope to chart who developed substance use disorders and be able to connect that with brain measures and other types of measures. Hopefully it'll give us the answer to the question you've just asked is, are there very early signals of people who are destined to actually use drugs?
So there might be the potential in the future for some kind of predictive test.
That's the hope. That's the hope. And, you know, the project just got started in the last year or two. And so I think that it'll be very exciting to see what's found.
I asked whether people were predisposed to addiction, and that seems to be a question that's out there. Are all addictive substances ultimately addictive with misuse?
Well, that's an interesting question. One of the focuses for our research work and research initiatives here in University of Minnesota is the concept of translational research in terms of how do we connect our work in more basic science in terms of cellular mechanisms and molecular mechanisms with clinical research. And one of the, as you know, there's work that's been done in study of mice or rats in terms of how they become addicted to substances. And one of the things that was very interesting to me that I learned from my basic science colleagues is that you can expose a set of rats, say 10 rats, to cocaine and offer them cocaine, but only about 20% of them will actually use it in a way that mimics kind of an addictive use pattern. This is something that it reminds us of the heterogeneity, that even though the rats are very similar, right, in terms of genetic makeup, not all of them, when exposed to a substance of abuse, will actually go on to abuse it. And I think there's a very similar thing going on also, I would suspect, with humans as well. And we know there are many factors that contribute to this. There are genetic factors, there are environmental factors that contribute to actual use and actually abuse.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton talking with Dr. Kelvin Lim. He's the Vice Chair for Research in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota, and we're talking about brain scans and what they reveal about addiction and behavior. But you also do research about brain injury, don't you?
Yes.
The question here is, are addicts injuring their brains?
The work in brain injury that you mentioned is work that we've been doing at the Department of Veterans Affairs, looking at traumatic brain injury in people who've suffered a mild traumatic brain injury. And so we have studies going on in terms of examining how is the presence of a brain injury affect brain structure and brain function. Now, I think there's evidence that continued use of substances, I think one of the most well-accepted and documented one is the effect of alcohol on the brain. Alcohol is, you know, it's a legal substance. It's commonly used, as we know, and there's very good data showing how it can affect the brain in very negative manner in terms of loss of brain tissue and loss of integrity of the white matter in the brain.
So there is some damage that's happening. Is chemical damage in any way correlated to physical damage? Do the same effects result?
Well, for example, in the alcohol situation, absolutely. I mean, alcohol can be is a known neurotoxin, and so it actually causes damage to neurons and loss of brain tissue.
Do you think your research and the research of your colleagues at the U of M, and for that matter nationwide, looking at this very difficult issue, will reduce, even remove, the social stigma that's been attached to addiction?
Well, we're hoping that illumination about the involvement of the brain and brain circuitry and the effects of brain development are so important and probably play major factors, as well, for example, genetics, in the development of substance abuse. I mean, I think that one key shift is that there's been a lot of effort by the scientific community and by NIDA and NIAAA is pointing out that the substance use disorders are brain disorders, are medical problems, okay? And that this work helps to emphasize and provide the information about how the brain is involved in addiction.
But your research would indicate that traditional treatment approaches like Alcoholics Anonymous's 12 steps are not as effective as we need.
You know, I think this is a very important issue. I think it shows the limitations of our existing treatments, and I think the desire by all people providing care for people suffering with addiction that we need better treatments. And I think our hope is that our work in looking at brain mechanisms, for example, associated with relapse as well as abstinence, can provide us with new treatment approaches.
Well, there are other areas of study, as I mentioned, at the University of Minnesota, that you're kind of linked to. Could you give us just a sort of a brief description of these other areas of research that are related?
Well, there's a initiative, several initiatives that I think are relevant to this topic. One of them is a set of what has been called medical discovery teams here at the medical school. And one of the medical discovery teams is focused on addiction. And so our idea is to build a team of researchers who can span what we call sort of this translational range from basic science to clinical research to, for example, work with humans so that we can elucidate better the mechanisms and perhaps develop new strategies for treatment. Another relevant area is an effort called MnDrive, which is focused. This particular MnDrive initiative is focused on brain conditions, in which we're using neuromodulation as a way to alter or modify brain circuitry as an intervention. And so, for example, one area that many of your listeners may be aware of is the use of neuromodulation techniques for Parkinson's, deep brain stimulation for people who are suffering from Parkinson's. We're working on studies as well to try and use other neuromodulation tools, such as non-invasive methods, such as transcranial direct current stimulation, as a strategy for altering the brain circuitry, for example, for enhancing that connection between nucleus accumbens and prefrontal cortex.
Well, you mentioned the Parkinson's condition, and that strikes me as sort of a variation of electroshock therapy. Is that what we're talking about here?
It's actually not. It's actually not. The deep brain stimulation involves the placement of electrodes in very specific parts of the brain related to movement. And then there's like a small device similar to what's used like a pacemaker that sends a little bit of current into these parts of the brain that then have tremendous effect, tremendously effective in reducing the symptoms, key symptoms of Parkinson's.
So you could just turn it off, I take it.
That's right. And there's some very great videos you can see on YouTube where you'll have someone who is having lots of tremor and has difficulty even moving. And the next video clip, you can see them dancing or playing the piano. It's so dramatic.
Your research is basically mapping the brain to see who's more inclined to relapse. And it would also seem that there would be useful research involved in developing medications that are not addictive or that don't involve interaction with the brain.
I think that there are many ways, but many potential ways to come up with new treatments. The approach that our imaging studies point to is, are there ways that we can alter, maybe improve that connectivity, improve the strength of communication between the nucleus accumbens and the prefrontal cortex? And so we're exploring some very non-invasive ways and simple ways, perhaps, that we can increase that connectivity and hopefully improve outcome and to help people stay clean.
Well, more power to you and your research, Dr. Lim. Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Kelvin Lim is Vice Chair for Research at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota.
And that was Prairie Public's Doug Hamilton having that conversation with Dr. Lim. And you can tune into South Dakota Focus with Stephanie Rissler Thursday at 8 Central, 7 Mountain. She'll have a conversation about the mental health care crisis in South Dakota.